What's going on, everyone? It's Isis Daniel, also known as the Millennial Psalm, and we're here for another Tasty Thursday podcast episode. And today we have a special guest. We have Felicity Carter joining us. Y'all, let's just pause for a second and acknowledge that there have been so many people who have sent me her article. A lot of people know that I've been very passionate about the neo-prohibition movement, been very vocal about, you know, the who, their stance, the people who have been in partnership with them, sharing information, insight on data reading and all of that. I have been very passionate about this topic. And that is why everybody and their mother, all right, was sending me Felicity's article. And don't you worry, it will be in the description so you can read it as well. But let's just talk for a moment. The reason why I knew I had to get her on this podcast was really just how she wrote her article. A lot of times when we discuss anything about the WHO, the World Health Organization, the neo-prohibition movement, and even when people discuss their feelings on non-alcoholic wines, a lot of times when we have this discussion, it lacks actual data or accurate interpretation of the data, right? Her article was amazing because it not only mapped out people's thoughts, their feelings, their views, but it also broke down the understanding of data. And I think that I know it might sound boring, you know, when you first hear like data, oh, that's just like a word that just doesn't sound fun. But when you understand how it's been broken down and also how it's easy to get lost or caught up in details and information that you don't quite understand. So after this podcast, I will be releasing a video where I talk about how I almost fell for a wine conspiracy theory that Felicity graciously debunked on. I didn't even ask her straight up. She just offered the truth and it totally shifted my perspective. But it's true. Sometimes when you're researching something and you're reading into something, you can not fully understand what it is that you read, and then you repeat what you think you understand, and sometimes the information could be incorrect, right? The same happens when you are looking at data or you're reading up on something and you only choose to share the details and information that align with your agenda. Now we have moved to the conversation of not being honest. You know what I mean? Like, now we aren't telling the truth. We're not pushing for accountability or change that actually is necessary, but more demanding change and control over people to fit it whatever agenda that you have. Like, this is, it's just dangerous. So anyway, we will talk about all this in this episode. I have so many thoughts. Again, I'll give you more thoughts at the conclusion of this podcast, but y'all listen to her. Let's have this dialogue. Let's have this conversation, because, you know, I just have so many thoughts. And I can't wait to really start to dissect and pull apart all of the layers of ideas that I have based off of this conversation. Okay. All right, y'all. So let's go ahead and jump right on in. If you know the song, you better sing along. Tasting Thursday. Get it. Tasting Thursday with your girl, the Millennial Psalm. I am she is me, and we are here for another Tasting Thursday. Let's get into it. Based in Europe, Felicity Carter is the founder of the Drinks Insider podcast and content consultancy, as well as editorial director of Arany Global, the fine wine think tank headquartered in London. Previously, she was founding executive editor of The Drop at Picks, editorial consultant for LiveX, and editor-in-chief of Meininger's Wine Business International, which she built into the world's premier business publication with subscribers in 38 countries. Her work has appeared in The Age, in Sydney Morning Herald newspapers in Australia, and in The Guardian USA, among many others. She is a well-known keynote speaker. How you doing, Felicity?
I'm great, and I'm so excited to be here.
Oh my gosh, I am on fire about you being here. Everyone knows how I've been talking about the neo-prohibition movement and how I think that we as an industry don't take it seriously enough. I know that there's been a lot of chatter, but talk to me more about your thoughts on the neo-prohibition, and then we'll dive deeper into everything else. But what are your thoughts?
Okay, well, so first of all, I've stopped using the term neo-prohibition because I realize that it gets in the way of people's thinking. Whenever I do a presentation or talk about it, mm-hmm. people think of the word prohibitionist and they think of what happened in America in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And what's happening now is quite different. So people say to me, no, it'll never ban alcohol. You know, it didn't work the first time. And that's not what people are talking about. There is a concerted push by people who claim they don't want to ban alcohol, but they do want to convince us to stop drinking it. Mm-hmm. So I got interested in this about a year ago when I interviewed somebody from Portugal, and she was saying, you know, there's this monster coming for us. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I started looking into it. And now I think, yeah, there's a monster.
Mm. Oh my gosh. It's so crazy because every time, literally before we got on this podcast, I was talking to a wine colleague and he was like, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. There's too much money in it. And I think that the prohibition in the States gave us evidence that it is always possible. But I would love to go a little bit deeper because you are saying that they're two different things and you wouldn't call it the neo-prohibitionist movement. So what would you reference it as?
I call it the anti-alcohol movement. I think that's a more accurate way of saying it. And in fact, when I talk about this, I don't talk about wine anymore either. I talk about alcohol, because particularly if I'm talking to people in the Mediterranean. So I was giving a presentation in Italy a couple of weeks ago, and people in Italy, that's got nothing to do with us. That's the spirits and beer people that do all the bad stuff. That, you know, everybody knows that wine is part of a healthy lifestyle. And I go, wine is not safe. To the anti-alcohol people, it is all just alcohol. That's all it is, and it's got to go.
Man, oh my gosh. All right, let's pause. Let's pause and go back to your bio real quick. So I'm happy that we were able to touch on that. So there's more on that on the rest of the podcast. You guys stay tuned. But before we dive in, I would like to know just a little bit more about you. We read your bio, but tell me more about Drinks Insider Podcast.
Oh, okay. So the podcast I haven't yet launched. I've done like 8 interviews, and have I launched it yet? I have not.
Okay.
I've been so busy with this topic. It's taking up a lot of my time. So I'm a freelance writer. I'm a reporter. I'm Australian, as you can probably tell from my accent.
Come on.
I've been in Europe for 15 years now. I came here to take a job as the editor of a wine trade magazine called Meiningen's. And then I moved from that to work for a short-lived tragic startup called Pix, where I was the executive editor for the drop. And since then, I work now as the editorial director for a group in London called Arini, which is a fine wine research group. And as well as that, I do lots of writing. And at the moment, my obsession is alcohol and health policy.
Okay, so let's go ahead and drive all the way back into it then. I mean, honestly, you guys, I love to have my experts come on because we got to get into the details, all right? So let's talk health. I think that is the first line of business whenever we're talking about alcohol, but more specifically wine, because I know that in the wine space, we are not technically supposed to say wine is healthy. Would you like to give us a little bit more background on that?
Sure. Okay. So in the 1920s, somebody who was a researcher at Johns Hopkins called Raymond Pearl discovered, and this was in the middle of Prohibition, that people who drank moderate amounts of alcohol had better health outcomes either than people who drank heavily or people who didn't drink at all, which was a very surprising finding. And he got a lot of flack for it at the time. You know, people, there's a lot of pushback. But then in the 1980s, some French researchers looked at this and said it's an effect they call the J curve, which is that at very low amounts of wine, your health outcomes are better. And then as you begin to consume more, your outcomes are worse. So alcohol is a drug and it's a dose-dependent drug. At small doses, it seems to have a cardiovascular protective effect. Now, the problem with this is this has been decided by lots of what's called observational studies. So people have, there are these vast studies. There's one in the States called the Framingham Study. There's one in the UK called the Biobank, the Civil Service, where they take large populations of people and ask them about their drinking. And of course, people lie. And so you have to, if it was one study where the J curve appeared, you'd have to think to yourself, well, is it true? But over and over and over, when populations have been studied, even accepting the fact that people will underreport how much they drink, the J curve keeps coming up. So what's happened in the last couple of years is the WHO came out in January 2023 and they said there's no safe level of alcohol. And they said, first of all, even if it does have these cardiovascular protective effects, which they don't necessarily agree with, it doesn't matter because alcohol will give you cancer. So what you are gaining in heart health or reduced risk for diabetes, you're giving up in cancer. And this is the very contested area. So I've spoken to medical statisticians about this. I've looked at the research. And alcohol is a carcinogen if you drink it heavily. There's no doubt about that. It is a very toxic substance in high levels. But the fight is over. Is there really no safe level? That's not true. It's a no safe level in the sense that you can't calculate the moment at which problems begin for everybody. And so on that basis, you can say there's no safe limit. But that's kind of a statistical trick. It doesn't mean that if you drink lightly, you're going to get cancer. So that's the fight that's going on at the moment.
So dangerous because everything's all about words and how we use them, right? And even data and how we read them. So in response, you came out with the article, How Neo-Prohibitionists Came to Shape Alcohol Policy. Now, this is something that I want to dive a little deeper in for not only myself because I care, but also for our listeners because I know that here in the States, there are a lot of health choices and educational choices that are being taken away from us. And in response to this anti-alcohol conversation, I am pro moderation. I am pro paying attention to your health. And sometimes this, especially if you have maybe an addictive personality, maybe alcohol isn't for you. However, if not, anything that is done in excess is always going to have a negative effect.
That's
Right.
right.
So I would like to know, I know you were talking about who are the people behind this movement. Is that something you're comfortable diving in a little bit with?
Yeah, sure. So there's a number of groups which started out in their life as temperance groups. One of them was called the International Order of Good Templars, which was a spin-off of the Freemasons. It was started in 1851. Now, what happened in the 20th century is that they reinvented themselves as public health groups. And so I've also stopped talking about temperance groups because whenever I do this, people think I'm talking about Christian religious groups being, the old-fashioned temperance groups, and they're not. If you look at their social media or you look at their blog posts or whatever, they're absolutely not. They now call themselves public health people. And many of them are taxpayer funded. There are groups in Europe that have been elevated to non-governmental status. And they sit in Brussels. They have offices in Brussels paid for by taxpayers' money, and they lobby governments about alcohol policy. But their roots were in temperance, and that's very much reflected in the kind of policies they're pushing for.
It's insane. I was actually going to ask, just in case people aren't familiar with what temperance groups are, what specifically were they in the beginning and how are they showing up now as the public health groups?
That's a very good question. So, in the 19th century, there were a lot of groups that wanted people to stop drinking alcohol. And there's very, I was reading a history about this the other night. And on the one hand, you had a lot of suffragettes involved in the temperance movement because alcohol was a big problem with domestic violence. And if you were married to somebody who was violent, you couldn't divorce them. Or if they drank away all the money, that was just too bad. So early feminists were very involved in the temperance movement. But actually, if you look at it, the temperance movement was largely a attempt to, in some, I shouldn't say largely, but in some ways, it was an attempt to shore up the position of white Protestants, because you had this influx of particularly Irish Catholics into the United States, and also German immigrants who drank a lot. So temperance was a way of sort of posher people, you know, asserting themselves as morally righteous against people who were drinkers. And so there were a lot of, I mean, there was a confluence of a lot of things. Alcohol did cause a lot of problems, and like I said, particularly around domestic violence. So it had a lot of women who were interested in it. And it culminated in prohibition, which was a disaster for the anti-alcohol groups because they became extremely unpopular. So what a number of them did was they went overseas. They took the message overseas to places like Sri Lanka, New Zealand, Africa, parts of South America, where they found more or less places that were interested or not interested. But one of the places they went was Scandinavia. And Scandinavia has also traditionally had big problems with alcohol. And that's really the moment that they become non-governmental organizations, where they find funding from government and they sort of become official bodies and move from being temperance groups to being sort of public health groups.
This is insane. My mind is going so
Stop me if I talk too fast. It's my worst trait. Well,
you absolutely aren't. You are very clear and I am appreciating it. But there is a group. So I should say this to you. Your article that was released in March has been sent to me so many times. It's insane. So kudos for that. But there is a particular public health group that has been active since the prohibition. And as you were saying, in reference to your article, how they kind of lost a lot of traction, not only during the prohibition and how people weren't so much of a fan, but then also during AA and all of that, where people were starting to try to take responsibility for their alcohol abuse and also in the pursuit of drinking in moderation, right? There was a downtick. So this is where I really want to know more about your thoughts. We saw an opportunity during the pandemic, right? During COVID, people are trying to, well, even post-COVID, people are trying to be more cautious about what they're putting in through their bodies. And alcohol is definitely one of the things that people are being more cognizant about. Do you believe that this movement, and I believe you said it in your article, which I actually, now that I'm thinking about it, you did. I think so. Correct me. But do you believe that the pandemic opened up an opportunity for these
groups?
Yes,
and it did it in a couple of ways. Yeah, so after my article came out, I was contacted by a lot of different people, and some of them work in Brussels, which is Brussels is very, very important, because when the EU make legislation, it rolls out across the continent and it becomes a standard for the world in many important ways. So when you do health legislation, a lot of people look at what other countries are doing. So Canada has changed its guidelines. So a lot of people in the United States are going, well, Canada knows what they're talking about, so maybe we should take notice. So this is very important. So what happened during COVID is very interesting. So for the first time, we saw governments behaving, I want to be careful how I say this, because the COVID restrictions were done for very good reasons. You know, it was a novel virus. Certainly in Europe, you know, when the news came out about the deaths in northern Italy, people were panicking. And governments had to take a response. And the response that they took looked a lot like a totalitarian government response. I mean, it really, we all began to live under police states, you know, with lockdowns and so on. So governments discovered powers that they had never used before. And it changed the way of thinking that what governments were responsible for in terms of health and well-being. On the other hand, you also had people for the first time who understood the good things that government could do, that, you know, that governments could transfer payments, that a lot of people's lives actually improved during the pandemic. So expectations about what governments could do went up. And this is all, you know, I want to stress that a lot of this was very, very positive, but it's left a legacy where people are much more willing to accept paternalistic legislation if it's being done for public health. And the other thing is that COVID made people think about mortality. It made them think a lot about death and about health. So you have all of these things happening at once. So you get a lot of interest in health. The media has picked up on it. The big newspapers have data scientists inside who can see the uptick of interest in health. So they're running a lot more articles around health. But there's another side to this, which is tobacco. So one of the great health victories of the last 20 years was the fight against tobacco. And that was done with a lot of people thinking about how you could stop people smoking, how they could defeat big tobacco. But it left behind a public health infrastructure, and people don't go away when the fight is over. So a lot of people who were involved in the fight against tobacco have had to find new enemies to fight because otherwise they can't pay the bills. So you see over and over that groups that were involved in the things called, Tobacco Institute or whatever, have become the tobacco and alcohol, or in some cases, the tobacco, alcohol, and food initiatives, and they're also looking at things like sugar. So there's a whole sort of so you've got a public that's very willing to listen to health messages, and you've got an infrastructure that knows how to fight because they did it with tobacco, and they need to keep fighting things in order to keep grant money coming in. That's not the full story. There are, of course, people who are, alcohol does do terrible, terrible damage. And of course, there are people who are genuinely concerned about that. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about groups whose function is to act as anti-alcohol groups, as opposed to thinking about, alcohol in in a broader sense.
You know, I think that's actually a great segue into my next question because we, as a world, are responding to the WHO, the World Health Organization, and their no safe level of alcohol consumption, right? And it's interesting because I had on a previous podcast, I was talking to someone who referenced tobacco and how when people were coming out and saying it's not healthy for you, a lot of people were saying, well, one cigarette a day, it can have health benefits for you. So that is what their argument is when we talk about alcohol being quote unquote healthy or having health benefits, I should say. We know that there are influences by these public health groups that are causing the WHO, the World Health Organization, to, from our perspective, especially within the wine space, misinterpret data. Do you agree with that
Well, I
phrase before
don't
I move
think they're
on?
influencing the WHO. They're partners with the WHO, which is a different thing. It's very clear from watching social media and stuff. There are people inside the WHO who themselves are very, very anti-alcohol. I think some of this is inappropriate. I think that people who have sort of these particular views should not be influencing public policy. I have to say, a lot of them, a lot of them are very well-meaning. Could you go back and ask me your question? I've just forgotten what it was. Oh,
I guess what I'm
was it the correct
trying
characterization?
to.
Yes, but it's really important that I don't lead people into thinking it's a conspiracy theory. What has happened is a confluence of events which has allowed people who otherwise wouldn't be particularly powerful to suddenly have a voice in ways that they haven't before, and that is having an impact. What I have to be very, very clear about is that alcohol is a dose-dependent drug, and at certain levels it becomes toxic. And there is no question about that. There's no question that it becomes unhealthy in multiple ways, including being carcinogenic. What the debate is over is at that light to moderate level, and that's where the science is being skewed. But going back to tobacco, so the tobacco, the issue is tobacco people lied. They did a disinformation campaign. They distorted the science. They went out of their way to cause a fog around what was known about tobacco. And when you read the literature of the anti-alcohol groups, they say that alcohol people are doing exactly the same thing, that they're using the techniques of big tobacco to try and cast doubt on the science. But in this case, that's not true. The science really is disputed. And the people who are actually distorting the statistics are the anti-alcohol people. But it's very easy to say, to point fingers and go, big alcohol's behaving like big tobacco.
It's so dangerous. Because I personally, and you already kind of touched on J curve and moderate drinking and wine in moderation, right? I think that either side of the spectrum is too much. And that's why I am so pro light to moderate consumption, and that I don't think that we as an industry, specifically in wine, but even if you wanted to say all of alcohol, I think should come together and make it clear that it's truly the moderation that we are not acknowledging enough to be the healing factor of both sides. From my perspective, and I would love to know your thoughts on this as well, I think when we go the anti route is when things start to go underground. So that was something that we did experience here in the States during the prohibition, right? It was illegal, but it didn't mean it stopped. In fact, to me, I think it created a culture underneath where if it's illegal, now everything goes. And if we're already struggling with alcoholism and now it is illegal and now people are making alcohol in their tubs and wherever else, it's creating an atmosphere where overconsumption is normal. So what is your response to these groups? I know that some of these public health groups to me, I think they contradict. It's like this appearance of moderation, but then when you actually pay attention to what's being said in the WHO and what's being quoted, it is anti-alcohol and zero tolerance.
Well, first of all, they're not planning on banning it. They know that that doesn't work. I should say they. I mean, I'm sounding like a conspiracy theory, but there's no push from anywhere to ban alcohol. What is being attempted is what's called denormalization. And this is what finally worked with tobacco. So denormalization is two things. One is you remove... They removed tobacco from anywhere that you could actually smoke. So took it away from restaurants, took it away from theatres, took it away from sporting events. So tobacco is perfectly legal. Nobody will stop you buying it, but you can't smoke anywhere, right? So that's, which was, and again, I want to emphasise this was a public health miracle, you know, getting rid of the ability to smoke. But the second thing they did was they stigmatised smokers. So they made it so that only kind of scumbags smoked. And what this meant was that people could do more and more draconian legislation and nobody said stop, because once you stigmatize a group of people, you can do anything. And so legislation began to push more and more into things that became a tax on poverty in some ways, where the really hardcore smokers were still beginning to, you know, we're still spending more and more money on cigarettes. So in some ways those taxes became counterproductive, or people started to force things like plain packaging in some countries, which didn't do any good, which didn't have any sort of effect on people. So that's what's being suggested for alcohol. If you look at the policies that are being suggested in WHO documents, it's to remove alcohol from as many places as possible, to remove all advertising and marketing of alcohol, and to just take it out of public view. And so one of the things that's been suggested is to remove alcohol from anywhere that children might be present, which sounds reasonable until you think about all the places that children might be present, from restaurants to sporting events to theatre. You know, so even though I don't think that would ever actually happen, but if you think about it, it's a quite draconian suggestion, but it still doesn't ban alcohol.
Interesting. That's actually a new perspective that I highly respect.
And by the way, I want to be very clear. I have no complaints about anything that was done against tobacco. It did save so many lives. But yeah, should that same category of legislation be used against other things? That's the question.
Hmm. If there is success in denormalizing the consumption of alcohol and where we drink it, how can you see it affecting the wine industry specifically, but if you want to go more broad on alcohol across the board, please?
Well, it's already beginning to happen. All you have to do is do what they say, which is just say alcohol causes cancer, and everyone goes, well, I'm not touching it then. That's you know, I don't want to get cancer. So one of the things that's been suggested is that there should be big cancer warnings on alcohol, that it should say, you know, alcohol causes cancer. And this is where there's a lot of scientific debate, because it is absolutely true that heavy consumption of alcohol will raise your risk of cancer. It doesn't in anything like the same way that it did with tobacco. It's not that carcinogenic. It's not as carcinogenic as tobacco. But so what the industry is saying is they're saying, well, we're happy if you say heavy consumption of alcohol is carcinogenic, but light to moderate consumption of alcohol is not carcinogenic. And this is where the dispute is. This is where the scientific and medical dispute is.
I think it's worth the fight. Do you think that there are positive effects of a fear-based motivation behind this? You know, it can cause cancer. Let me know if that question doesn't make sense.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because what seems to happen in these scenarios is that what happens is that light and moderate drinkers, because this has actually been tested in various places, is that light to moderate drinkers immediately stop drinking. They're like, yeah, no, I don't want, you know, I don't want to get cancer. But heavy drinkers, people who have a problem, do not stop drinking. And so this really comes to the heart of sort of public health policy. Should you make policy for an entire population, tell everybody to stop drinking, or would it be better from a public health point of view to pinpoint problematic drinking? And there's a lot of arguments that actually you'd be better off targeting problematic drinking, that if you've got a problem, you're not going to be stopped by these kinds of warnings, or you're not going to be stopped by tax rises and stuff like that. What the anti-alcohol groups is, they want a population level intervention to stop as many people drinking as possible.
Man, oh my gosh.
Rather than targeting heavy drinkers.
Right, because their goal isn't necessarily the people who overconsume. It's broader than that.
Well, it is. I have to say, from everybody who's had any brushes with these groups, the things that they tell me is that they're very, very idealistic and very, very concerned about the evils of alcohol. Alcohol can do pretty terrible things. Mm-hmm. So the fight really is over, is any level of alcohol okay? And the answer for them is no, it's not. Alcohol is so deadly and so destructive that no level of it is okay. Whereas, of course, if you love wine, you go, pardon me, actually, that's not true. If you're a responsible drinker, this is a fantastic addition to life.
So do you think that it does threaten the option of choice? I get that in acknowledging the issue, again, for people who struggle with moderation, struggle with paying attention and not overconsuming, now by acknowledging that there is an issue in all of the, really the, it leads to a lot of fatal mortality rates that are so high, right, when it comes to alcohol. But are we removing choice? And is that really the issue at hand in our approach to this issue, if we go to that extreme?
I think the issue for me is an issue of scientific integrity. Mm-hmm. It's, for me, this is what this is really all about, that there's so much being said and written which is not scientifically correct. And there are policies being made on the basis of things which don't hold up in the real world. And that's what I really object to.
Interesting.
So the scaremongering absolutely works. It's very clear that if you tell people that alcohol is going to give them cancer at any level, that there's a group of people who will stop drinking anything. And that's already begun to happen. You know, and I want to emphasize, alcohol at a certain level is really bad for you. There's no doubt about that. But at a light to moderate level, it can really enhance your life.
So I will say this. The issue, correct me if my interpretation is correct, the issue isn't necessarily just, you know, the effects of alcohol and people's stance on it. It's the influence in the door that is currently being opened by acknowledging and giving impact or response to false information. If we are able to make policies based off of false information, what other policies can be influenced by that? Outside of just alcohol.
That is a very interesting question. So, you know, when I was at a wine and health congress last year, and somebody from the Spanish government actually said to me, if they get this through with alcohol, meat and dairy are next. And I've told that story to so many people, and every single person has gone, good, you know, we need to get rid of meat and dairy. And I'm like, for the planet, yes. I actually, you know, I don't eat that much meat myself. But if we're going to get rid of it, we should get rid of it based on the correct story, which is that it's, you know, farming is really bad for the environment, not based on bad science about its, you know, its effects on us, on bad nutritional science. And actually that's beginning to happen as well. So if you look at all of these things, if you look at alcohol, if you look at sugar, if you look at, you know, junk food, if you look at this, the consumption of the last 20 years has fallen, right? And it's happened with alcohol as well. You know, the peak of alcohol consumption in the UK was in 2003, and alcohol has continued to drop ever since. So you have to say to yourself, why is this being treated like a major public health emergency now, when we have the lowest consumption of all of these things in 50, 60, 70 years? And the answer is because it's in somebody's interests to make this a massive health issue. And while I am saying that for some people it is a health issue, right? Well, I'm not denying that at all.
Okay, and it is very important that we acknowledge that because I was actually having a conversation earlier today about, you know, vegan wines and clean wines and all of that. And in that dialogue, I was saying, I know that there's some people who feel that it's unnecessary and it's just a money grab, but I think it's also important that we acknowledge, though there might be some wineries that take advantage of that because they can afford to, there are consumers that are vegan outside of just not wanting to harm animals. Some people have health concerns that they have to, take into account, and it becomes a lifestyle. You also want to have vegan wines. And so it's never just one-sided, and it's important for anyone who's listening, anyone who's reading any type of article to understand that your perspective and how you see things is just one perspective. To honor other people's view is very, very important, and experience is very, very important. I think, okay, I'm not even sure where to go right now. Is there anything that, based off of this conversation, that you want to share and highlight a little bit more?
I think some really good things have come out in the last few years over interest in health. I think the trend towards ingredients labeling is really, really positive. I think that in those ways, there's been some great questions asked, and we're going to get ingredients labeling, which I think is terrific for consumers. I think people should, I think thinking about your health, there's no downside. I think thinking about your health is great. But I don't think it should be based on fear mongering. And that is kind of what's happening at the moment.
Yeah, I don't agree with it either. I think truth is always enough, despite what everyone else. I get that we have our agendas and we want to, push whatever we believe in. But it has to be centered in truth. And we have to give people the option to choose it. I'm 100% all about that. So please tell us, because we're going to round out. I want you to come back on the podcast, or at least come on a Tasting Thursday, where we can talk more and actually open up this dialogue with consumers and other wine professionals, because this is a topic that needs to continue to happen. And I want to say, before we jump into anything else, I just want to say thank you for actually shifting my mindset, because there were a couple questions that I had. And honestly, when you talk to certain people, there is this kind of conspiracy theory nugget that starts to get planted.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing about that. So after my article came out, I got lots and lots of emails from people sending me social media posts or whatever. And they were going, is this them hard at work, undermining alcohol? And I was like, you have to understand that they, the public health groups, are normal lobbyists. We're not talking about a shadowy cabal that rule the world. We're talking about quite often very poorly funded people who, their job is to go and work for an NGO and write grant papers and write policy papers. And that's what they do every day. It's no more of a conspiracy than any other form of lobbying or non-governmental organization. It's just that they came along at the right time with the right people with the right message. And it is a confluence of events which have worked in their favor, but they're not an all-powerful, shadowy, highly well-funded cabal that are in charge of manipulating the world.
Well, okay, before we get off. So taking that next thought, one argument has been, at least in the States, there, billions of dollars are contributed to our economy from the wine industry alone. Not even talking about all of alcohol, right? With there being so much money in that, I know that you've made it very clear that, it's not like it's just going to go away. But do you think that that is an influence that will hinder the success of this movement, at least in the States, but also globally?
So I can't emphasize enough that this is not something that is happening at a political level. This is a perception level. And, once you say to people, alcohol is going to give you cancer, you've won the debate. You don't have to get legislation or shut the thing down. The message will do it for you. The wine industry, unfortunately, is not that powerful. It's a small, tiny little industry compared to other industries. I think... I think the fight, as such, it is over the perception, not over anything else. Will we get sort of labels that say any amount of alcohol will give you cancer? That's a fight that is going to happen in the future, and that's probably going to happen in the next couple of years. But this is about perception, and that's where the problem is.
So what advice would you give to people like me who care about this issue, others who are within the wine industry and want to, I don't know, who care about the integrity? I care about integrity, and I think I'm receiving that you care as well. What advice would you give to us who want to make sure that we are moving forward in truth?
Look, I get asked this a lot, and the only thing I can say is that the evidence says that light to moderate drinking will not do any harm to your health. So go forth and, drink alcohol in moderation, preferably with food. And I think, one thing I think that wine doesn't make a very good argument for, and one of the things that I really like about it, is it's not really the wine itself, it's what it represents. We live in this world where everything is about, algorithms, and it's about profitability, and it's about the gig economy, and it's about the hustle. And with wine, it comes in a 750 bottle. You can't drink it by yourself. You have to share it. You have to sit down with other people, and you have to have a conversation, and you have to have food. And it's this kind of riposte to the world we live in, where it makes you slow down and be with other people. And I think that's the most precious and valuable thing that we should cherish. I think that's a really strong argument that we can make, that taking a bottle of wine with a group of friends is about taking time with other people. And we know that people aren't doing that anymore.
Okay, that was perfect. That was perfect. One question. I'm doing a case study on wine culture. Just understanding people behind the wine, right? And what influences our purchases. And I've been reading this book where it says, before you get into trying to convince people to buy anything, understand what they believe. What is the core belief? And during the last episode, I was the phrase was, I believe that wine is meant to be shared. And so
Yeah,
in you saying
absolutely.
that, it's definitely something that when he said, I said, yes, that I think that might be the core belief in wine. It is meant to be shared. It's meant to cultivate community. And there's a way to enjoy wine in a safe environment without overconsumption. So, I mean, like you said, it's one bottle. We only have four glasses for real. You know what I'm saying? So I love it. That works for me. Anything you want to leave for the people before we skedaddle?
I just want to say thank you so much for this opportunity to come along and blurt out all this sort of dry policy stuff I've been learning. It's been a treat.
Thank you. When your podcast comes out, I want to be there. Okay.
When I finally do
Listen,
it.
it's one of the hardest parts. One thing that someone told me, and especially when I was reading about starting a podcast, the hardest part of having a podcast is starting it. So if there's any way that I can help you and encourage you through that process, you just let me know. We're connected now. We're friends. I don't know if you know that now,
That's
but
right. We're like this. We're like blood brothers now. So
Yes,
yes, I
okay.
will call on you.
So let me know if there's anything that you need, but thank you so much for your wisdom and your expertise in this topic. And I'm excited to see what you're gonna do next. Let's go. All right.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Y'all see what I'm saying? Felicity is awesome. I loved her energy, knowledge. It was just a great conversation. And I just want to acknowledge that I felt like I was a little rambly during this conversation because nothing, as far as my questions kind of went as planned, I guess I could say. Because, I obviously, I do my research, I wrote out my questions, and I was ready. But there was just a natural flow of the conversation that had my mind racing and running. So, my bad. But I have no shame because, like I said, this was just a great conversation that shifted my thinking. And I guess I will acknowledge what that shift was. So, I already told you guys that after this podcast is released, I will release a story time video on Instagram talking about how I almost became a wine conspiracy theorist. And this conversation was the thing that saved me. Why? Because let me just break it down. Number one, when you are in the beginning of learning something or you're new to something, you are a sponge. you're soaking up as much knowledge to gain as much of understanding as you possibly can in it, whatever the topic is, right? And for me, when I started down this road of wine legislation, of non-alcoholic wines, of Congressional Wine Caucus, Wine America, Wine Institute, breaking down the WHO and all these other groups that are in partnership with them, it was very much a slippery slope into nonsense if you do not have the right conversations with the right people or ask the right questions, right? I was asking the right questions. I believe I was getting pretty good resources as far as what I was reading, but I do think that who I was talking to might not have been the best choice. I had a very weird, skeptic, strange conversation. I've had a couple strange conversations when it comes to this whole WHO and the conspiracy theories of wine. But honestly, the conversation was what tipped me over. Because I was still in this position where I was trying to gain understanding, I was also impressionable, and it took me talking to Felicity for a lot of the conspiracies that were starting to swirl in my head to be debunked, right? And the reason why I want to highlight this is because this is why I've been so quiet. A lot of people, you know, they come to me and they're like, why aren't you posting? Why aren't you whatever? And the truth is, I understand what it is that I want to talk about. But I know that my conversation and choice of topic right now can be dangerous. I have to be responsible with what I put out there. And truthfully, if I would have just ran with some of the conversations that I had in the past versus waiting to have dialogue with someone who I knew was truly educated on the topic, I would have been out here spreading more misinformation, even with me trying to correct other misinformation that's been put out there, right? So it's important to gain understanding before you speak sometimes. And I'm saying that not to check anyone, but really to hold myself accountable and to tell you guys that I'm holding myself accountable. I do not want to be responsible for putting out information that is not true. And I also want to thank people like Felicity, who is doing not just doing the research, but really laying out her findings in a easy to understand manner, and then also having the time and availability to further explain her findings on this podcast episode. I mean, it's just amazing, right? So challenge yourselves, question always, drive out and try to find as many sources as possible, sources that don't even always have to align. You know what I mean? Just making sure that you are seeking truth and not what is convenient or that sounds scary. Okay. So yeah, thank you, Felicity, for joining us. Thank you for tuning in, my lovely, lovely listeners. If there's anyone that you want me to interview, please, you know, tag them, email me, all the things at the Millennial Sum, Gmail, whatever. Just let me know and talk to me, okay? I love you guys. Follow me on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at the Millennial Sum. And I will see y'all next week. All right. I love you. Bye.